Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week we look at restraint, why it might be necessary for living a moral life, and why there might be some areas in which restraint might not be called for. So let's begin by being unrestrained. A couple of weeks ago, the annual Oxford Symposium on Food and Cooking turned its attention to food and ethics. One of the speakers was the philosopher Stephen Kramer from Southwest Minnesota University, and he addressed a very interesting question. When you're a kid and your parents tell you to eat up your food because there are poor children in Africa who would be glad of that, what sort of moral lesson are they teaching? And should you listen?
The paper sort of introduces broader moral issues that many philosophers and others have raised about the ethics of food, and I am in complete agreement with a lot of their arguments, and I'm in agreement with a lot of the claims they make. We shouldn't waste food. We shouldn't raise animals in a way that promotes their cruelty and suffering. We shouldn't waste water. There are a lot of these issues. I also agree with the deeper lesson that we ought to sacrifice our own desires for morality sometimes, you know. My question is, not should it be the case sometimes, but must it always be the case? Because that's a far more demanding principle.
Well, I suppose that one answer is, faced with two actions, must you be required to do the morally better action? I suppose one would say either that's what must means, or that's what acting morally means.
Yeah, and for a long time in my career, that's been my answer. Morality is demanding. That's the mustness of it. But as I've thought about it more, I have really grown to question that view. Must our lives always be ruled by the moral realm? Kant thought moral laws were universal and absolute. They spread throughout our lives, in every aspect of our lives. That's the question I want to raise. Is that so? Why think it's so? What kind of life would that look like?
Well, you mentioned Immanuel Kant, the great 18th century German philosopher, but we could go beyond that to a 19th century British philosophy, which is utilitarianism, much associated these days with the name of Peter Singer, the Australian philosopher. And Singer, of course, is a vegetarian because he thinks that I don't think he actually thinks that animals have rights, because utilitarians are not very interested in rights, but he certainly thinks that animals have interests, and that the pig's interest in living is rather more significant than my interest in eating a rasher of bacon. The problem I have always had with utilitarianism is that everything is a moral decision. Where do I stop looking at the list of ingredients? At what point do I stop worrying? But then perhaps there shouldn't be a point at which I stop worrying.
And that's the question I'm sort of wrestling with. And I am in agreement that every action we do carries moral implications. My claim is, and this is a claim Susan Wolfe originally raised in a paper called Moral Saints, where she's asking this same question. What would our lives really be like if we lived our lives under a meta-ethical principle that utilitarians and deontologists alike seem to accept, that we should always strive to do the morally better action? Now, what kind of life does that lead to ultimately? And I think if you go back to Singer's other arguments on famine relief, you see the extreme nature of such a life. Singer raises what seems to me a completely plausible argument that suffering from malnutrition is a bad thing. And if we can prevent a bad thing without sacrificing a morally comparable bad thing, we ought to do it. We can do it, at least those of us in the developed world. And so therefore we ought to, which means we ought to sacrifice everything we can till we're in a situation of sacrificing something almost comparable to malnutrition. Now, it's not hard to imagine what my life would look like, right? I love food, and I try and combine both my love of food and philosophy, and I'm not overly consumptive, but I do have imported olive oils. You know, I do have balsamic vinegars. I do have fleur de sel and imported salts. And let's not even get into the spice drawer and saffron. And these things add a great variety to my cuisine. But can I really say that if I had the choice between giving that money to somebody who's lacking of food and buying a few grams of saffron, from a moral standpoint, I don't think there's any issue. I ought to send the money elsewhere. But what would my life look like if I followed such an austere principle? It would seem to me to be a pretty dull life in the end. It's not that giving to others isn't a good thing, and we shouldn't praise it and we shouldn't do it. I just worry when the principle gets pushed to the point where it's a kind of absolute, that it's always right, that we're never allowed to set morality aside and look at life from a broader perspective. What is the nature of a good, rich human life? We always translate goodness to moral goodness, and that's what I want to challenge. It may be possible to lead a good life that isn't completely morally good.
Well, I suppose what we might want to do if we were considering that possibility is to look at those other aspects of a good life in terms of morality. I might want to say, for example, that being able to enjoy good food, this is an aesthetic pleasure, just as the pleasures of music or of literature are aesthetically desirable, and it is morally good that your life be enriched by these things. So I would still be looking at everything through a moral perspective, but I would just be broadening it a bit.
Yeah, and I've considered that move, and you know, at times I'm tempted by that move. It seems to me at that point we've collapsed morality, or we've broadened morality to a concept that it's just a choice. It includes everything. It now becomes meaningless as a term. What is a moral decision? Well, apparently everything is. But I really want to save that category of moral decision for identifying certain kinds of issues, certain kinds of values. And no matter how much I appreciate food and cooking, for me to say that it's a moral issue that I can serve a succulent roast of venison that I've harvested myself with food I've grown myself, there are moral issues embedded in that. But ultimately, I don't think all pleasures and all aesthetic pleasures in particular are moral issues. I want to keep those categories separate. That's what I think philosophy and philosophers like Peter Singer never confront. In his new book with Jim Mason, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter, his ultimate answer never challenges the philosophic tradition. The philosophic tradition, going back to Plato, says if you read the Phaedo, you find Socrates saying that philosophers shouldn't take account of the pleasures of food and cooking, right? These are just mere pleasures of the body. Singer challenges philosophy, rightly so, that food matters philosophically, but it only matters extrinsically because it's involved in nasty enterprises. The minute you clear that up, then all interest in food disappears. And that's where I think Singer's account is incomplete.
Well, I think Singer would say, and I think he says in a later edition of his first book, Animal Liberation, that once for him eating had been freed of guilt because he was no longer eating animals, he found a new pleasure in food.
And I think he's right about the guilt of eating certain factory farm meat. I don't happen to agree with him about eating meat altogether. I've largely banished factory farm meat from my diet, but I go out and hunt and shoot things that I'm sure he would have many arguments against. The concern is if we let morality rule like that, any aspect of our life that isn't dedicated to doing the absolute moral best we can has to be eliminated. The model for me is this constant reflection between the moral aspects of our lives and the non-moral aspects of our lives. And I believe that it's the non-moral aspects of our lives that philosophers just haven't touched very much on. And it's part of the reason why the field of aesthetics is such a poorly developed field, I think. Philosophers just haven't done well with this concept of the good life, even though that is exactly the concept that philosophy started with. Socrates' question, how should I live my life? Now, I don't want to say they live a bad life. They live a life of the mind that is incredible. They don't develop often many other aspects of their life. And I think that's a sort of consequence of Western philosophy's split of the mind and the body that's been commented on by a number of theorists, right? And feminist theorists have been very good at really pushing this critique about Western philosophy, and I think they're absolutely right on target. I mean, I studied environmental philosophy, and my philosophy professor lived on Cheese Whiz, which is this orange processed cheese product, crackers and cigarettes. To many philosophers, food is just an encumbrance, but so much of the body is. If we could do away with it, we'd be better. I disagree.
This is broadening the discussion a bit, but you say that philosophers are very bad at food and also bad at aesthetics. What about love and sex? Do you think these two have been neglected?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm painting with a broad brush here. There are philosophers who are wrestling with this. And particularly, I think this is the value that feminist philosophers have brought to the table. Sex, there's some interesting stuff out there, but it's largely conceptual and analytic, at least the stuff I've read. They're very good at the traditional stuff of getting down to definitions and parsing out concepts, but as far as getting to the true essence of it, I haven't seen much of interest.
So you mean if we're talking about love, we're talking about A feels an attraction to B under such and such circumstances and so on?
Yeah, you got it. That's it. Right on target.
Just finally, if we're going to live a good life, which might not necessarily be a morally good life, to what extent is this about forgetting or ignoring? I mean, you've described very well, it seemed to me, your own table and the succulent venison and the fleur de sel. Well, supposing you invited me and somebody else to dinner at your place and I turned up and said, well, unfortunately she couldn't come, I'm here, but instead I have brought this large photograph of a starving child in Africa, and we'll put that on the chair instead of her. That would be very rude of me, but it would remind you of what you'd been forgetting, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I don't think as philosophers we ever would promote that kind of life. It has to be, you know, in that Sartrean sense of authenticity, it has to be an authentic life. I have to be able to embrace what I'm doing and to not hide from it. That's part of the problem of food ethics, is so much of what we're involved in we hide from. I think that's part of the value of hunting for me. Yes, I have to look it in the eye. So I think we have to do it fully conscious of those starving people. And that, in fact, is a good thing. That keeps us from just devolving into that kind of gluttonous gourmand that is more about pleasure and taste. It's not that we don't want to live a morally good life. We don't have to lead the morally best life that we could. We don't want to go to that point where we're just ignoring the issues.
Okay, well, you've looked me in the eye like these deer you've killed. So, Stephen Kramer, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you very much, Alan. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Stephen Kramer from Southwest Minnesota State University on the morality of restraint at table. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and we turn now to self-restraint in general. James Franklin, we've met him before on the show, is an associate professor in mathematics at the University of New South Wales. He's also a philosopher and a member of the Restraint Project, a study of the virtue of self-restraint funded by the Australian Research Council. So what is the Restraint Project? And why do we need a project on restraint so much that there's a research council funding it?
It's because we've heard so little about it since the 1960s. If you go back to education and the common values of 100 years ago or 60 years ago. There was a lot of talk about virtues like self-control, thrift, temperance, sobriety, decency, cleanliness, politeness, and so on. And all of a sudden, we hear very little about those in the last, say, 40 years. And we hear instead about self-fulfillment, autonomy, having it all, as they say in some of the airport novels. Of course, I'm all for autonomy and freedom and self-fulfillment, but I wonder if we, in the course of going in that direction, we haven't let a few things slip off the plate that we still need to do.
Well, let's see how that works, and let's turn to happiness. You would, I assume, and this is perhaps relevant to the subject of restraint, you would draw a distinction, would you, between happiness and pleasure?
Yes, happiness is a much wider notion. Pleasure is certainly part of it, but having an appropriate meaning in life, for example, one that's absolutely speaking well-directed, is what we are aiming for. Deserved happiness, you might say.
We're social beings, of course, so what makes me happy might well be what makes you happy, or at least my pursuit of happiness might not interfere with yours. But it's when our ideas of happiness or the activities that contribute to our happiness are in conflict. Is this where restraint comes in?
Yes. It's not only when our ideas might conflict. You and I might very well agree on our ideas of happiness. It's just that we can't both have it at the same time. So, for example, if we're both very tired and it's our job to look after a baby, one of us has to stay awake. It's that kind of simple conflict, nothing to do with conflict of ideas or values, but just conflict in what has to be done. So we need to restrain our own search for pleasure because somebody else depends on us for their happiness.
Okay, well, assuming we were in that situation, one of us would have to sacrifice his happiness or a certain amount of his happiness or a certain amount of his happiness for a certain amount of time for the other.
Yes, that's right. And that person needs to have some training in the skills to do that, which is what I fear we may have lost in our education. For example, I look at the new census results and I see more and more 30-year-olds are living alone. Some of these may want to do that for their own independence and autonomy, but some of them, I'm sure, just don't have the skills to restrain their own desires for pleasure in the short term enough to live with other people.
So if I'm going to focus on the happiness of others, if I'm going to cultivate the qualities that enable me to live with other people, either at home or more generally in society, what are the qualities that I need to cultivate?
I need just the habit of temperance, of thinking about other people. Of course, I need the psychological skills to put myself in their place, walk in their shoes and understand what their needs actually are. I don't approve of people sacrificing themselves unnecessarily. It's just that sometimes it's necessary to sacrifice yourself. So a skill that may be needed is the skills you can get when you're younger by learning a team sport, for example. Team sport was very important in moral education 100 years ago. The skills of letting someone else score, for example. When the crunch comes and it's tough for you, you need to have the skills, the trained skills, and not have to think about it at the last minute.
Well, it's interesting you talk about team sports. The writer C.L.R. James, the West Indian writer who was both a Marxist political writer and a huge cricket enthusiast and wrote one of the great classics on cricket, Beyond a Boundary, he saw cricket as a sort of metaphor of life, and he saw cricket as a sort of model of an ideal cooperative society. Well, I'm afraid if you looked at cricket today, with all sorts of scandals arising in the game, and if you looked at football with, well, particularly what I call football because I'm English, soccer, with huge amounts of money being paid to star players, they're not really setting a tone, are they?
The professional end of the sport, unfortunately, is not. Though you have to remember, of course, that these people had to have trained early before they let rip. Amateur sport is much better for this sort of purpose where there isn't the feeling of need to win or huge rewards. The kind of team sport at school where there's just a very small reward, you win, you get feel good, you help someone else score, you feel good about that. That's the kind of training and sport we mean.
You mentioned temperance earlier as being a necessary quality. Well, it may be necessary, but it's not a terribly glamorous quality these days, is it?
Unfortunately, that's true. The downside of marketing temperance and restraint is that they're not glamorous. However, if you look back to the mid-20th century, there are ways of selling these things. I think the two experts in these, going back further, are Jane Austen, who could certainly make intemperance look very bad. For example, the picture of Lydia in Pride and Prejudice. Lydia is someone who is very intemperate and runs off with somebody very bad. Jane Austen certainly doesn't talk about her autonomy. She makes her look a very nasty piece of work. And then there is Casablanca of 1943, where Rick and Ilsa put their own life on hold and sacrifice themselves to the greater good, in this case, Ilsa's husband, Victor the Resistance Hero. They knew how to make restraint look good in those days. Glamorous, no, but noble, certainly.
Well, it's interesting you mention Casablanca because, of course, the restraint that we see in Casablanca is restraint that takes place. It's an act of self-sacrifice, if you like, emotional self-sacrifice, in the context of a vast global emergency. And it did occur to me while you were talking about temperance and how difficult it is to sell these days that one area in which it is being marketed, whether successfully or not, I don't really know, is the global emergency of our time, which is the environment. So people are always being urged to practice restraint and temperance in their consumption for the good of the environment.
Yes, sustainability is a kind of rebadging of the old restraint, but there's so much these days we expect our restraint to be outsourced to someone else, that it's the government's job to implement carbon trading or something. We're not going to really restrain ourselves except in a little bit of recycling and so on, unless everybody else does it. There are a few ways where we've been successful, notably car seat belts, for example, and there's much less drink driving than there used to be. But generally speaking, we haven't quite got the message that it's us that has to restrain ourselves, not society that has to impose restraint on us.
You've talked about autonomy, but does temperance here involve having a sense of who one is and of finding that if one performs certain acts, or indeed refrains from performing others that you ought to perform, you just can't live with yourself? Is that important?
It is essential to keep temperance going, especially when the going gets rough. You do need to have a sense of yourself as someone who wants to do the right thing, who wants to be noble. Without that, you won't have the stamina to keep going when there's somebody offering you drugs in a social situation where everybody's doing it, something like that.
What about the language of restraint? I mean, we don't always want to be told to be restrained. We don't always want a very moralistic language, but can we find a language of restraint that encourages us to speak in unselfconscious praise or approval of it?
This is a very difficult question. Certainly, Wowsers going back very much failed to sell restraint and created a reaction against it. And now when teenagers reach a situation where they should be restrained, somebody will say, "You're talking like your mother." This is, I think, one of the things that the Restraint Project should be working very hard on. We do need a much better language. The word sustainability has worked quite well, but there's something societal. It's not something personal you can be personally proud of in the way that people used to be proud of their thrift. People in the Depression were proud that they walked a mile to save a penny on a cabbage. Of course, we're still very easily shocked when people are unrestrained and the teachers are downloading internet porn, but we're, I think, not giving people the language or the self-images appropriate. But how to do it is very hard to say.
Well, can we educate children in values?
Yes, we can certainly educate children in values. So one thing that I recommend is that, for example, when you're talking about drug education, it shouldn't rely 100% on talking about harm. The normal thing is that people say that, well, if you take drugs, you'll harm yourself and maybe kill yourself driving, for example. But in addition, we need to give a picture that people should be proud of themselves if they're sober enough, for example, to drive their friends home.
Well, we could go on talking about this because it's a very interesting subject, but I'm now going to practice restraint by bringing this discussion to an end. James Franklin, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by John Diamond. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.